Well, that's the point that I think is critical. I think this is what we add to the mix, is our ability to back up and say, wait a minute, you marketing people are doing a great job because you're focused right on the old buck coming in through the cash register. And what we can do to help you is to give you that little bit of balance. We can help you bring in the buck through the cash register, but we can also give you this little bit of balance. Now that you've all gotten acquainted, just identify the product or service you're going to market, and then we'll go through some stuff here. That's all you need to do now, is just identify the product or service you're going to come to agreement. That's, of course, I realize that's the hardest part of all, but... Some decision on what it is you're going to just market here as we simulate some sessions for a couple hours? Yes? Okay. Now, yeah, and by the way, the coffee, the tea, and all that is here. You get up and wander around. I mean, I understand that you can still hear me because I got this thing turned up high. At 10 o'clock, we're going to take a break. Maybe they'll bring something in. If they don't, we won't take a break. Okay, keep listening while you're getting your coffee over there, because now we're going to talk about the next step. Strategic planning. Excuse me. Setting strategies in general. If there's one word that applies to all of this is, we need to know what outcomes are we after. In other words, what specifically... in terms of some measurable behavior, so let's put it outcomes in terms of measurable, observable behaviors are the strategic goals of the organization, for example, that you're with. Well, you just dreamed up a product or a service, so you couldn't possibly know what those are, but back home you would know what those are. And then what strategic objectives is marketing after? What outcomes do they want that will lead us to those goals? And usually, if it's a broad organization at all, the marketing objectives, they may be driving the thing by bringing in the bucks, but there will be lots of other strategic goals that are not marketing goals. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is that In the past years, we've seen the splintering of public relations, communications people. Well, I'm not in general corporate organizational interest anymore. I'm in marketing. Well, first of all, that's coming to a halt. The trend is very definitely reversed on that, because we begin to realize that here was the breakdown right here, that we sent all of you off to be in the marketing unit, and you were doing things that were contradicting what we were trying to do up here. And so that's why I just want to make this point. There's nothing we can do on our groups, because we don't know, you know, what the organizations that we're just dreaming up here might have, but I just want to make that point. Now let's drop down here to the realities. The marketing people have their objectives. Where do we come in? We need a strategic plan to serve both of those objectives, and that's the point I'm making. But for today, let's see if we can come up with a strategic plan just around the marketing objectives. So for today, we'll just forget that one, and we'll forget this one, and we're going to talk about the relationship, the outcomes that we need here to help support the marketing objective. Now, very often in your planning, the outcome is the same, right? The outcome is purchases or uses of service or getting into a position where one could use the service. So now let's take a look at some of the indicators that are available to us to really decide. If outcomes are behaviors, then we need to look at behaviors in a number of ways. There are three ways we need to look at behaviors. And believe me, listen, if you're willing to buy into this, I can guarantee it'll change the way you work, and it'll change the way your organization views you, and unless you're a rare exception, it'll make you far more valuable to your organization. If you can just start remembering that what we're here for is behaviors. There's three ways of looking at this. First of all, what types of behavior can we get? We can get people to do something. That's the first kind. Secondly, we can get people not to do something. Thirdly, we can ask people for just a willing suspension of disbelief, sort of, we can just ask for their consent to let us try something, and don't jump all over us while we're trying it. So we can get them to do something, not to do something, or just to give us consent to try some new idea. Now that third one is critical, isn't it? Because very often we need to keep our present customer base while we shift the product over into new technology, while we move it to also position with new markets, while we deal with competition that maybe has added an improvement that we need to get up to. So that third one is critically important. How do you hang on to the old gang and still kind of move over to a new gang? Koch found that out, didn't they? That it isn't always that easy. And maybe you need to think more about relationships than you do about market research and postulating that people are rational, which was a mistake that Koch clearly made when they were doing that. That's one way of looking at behaviors. The second way is to look at it from our end of the spectrum. And say, what is it we're really trying to do with our process? Here, there's three things we're trying to do. We're trying to motivate new behaviors. We're trying to reinforce existing positive behaviors. Or sometimes we have to modify negative behaviors. Now see, when you start looking at it like that, why all of a sudden you start questioning all those news releases you sent out last week, and the newsletter that goes out religiously every third Monday, because you start saying, so what? What has that got to do with these things that we're talking about? And sometimes it may have a lot to do. Sometimes it may only mean the tone or the regularity of the thing. It's become boring. It comes every third Monday. Let it come out maybe when there's something to say, and leave those poor people alone in the meantime. They'll love you for it. But just this is totally different thinking, because we're thinking about the outcomes and not the process. Now there's a third way of looking at behaviors, which is critical. And that is in terms of time sequence. Because if you think about it, there are really two elements of time on behaviors. One, we can be looking for immediate behaviors. If you sell margarine, and your goal, and you're established in the marketplace, and your goal is either to hold sales at a current level, and I've never heard such a goal, it's always to add 5 or 10%, then you need immediate behaviors. So you're going to have to do things that have some immediate payoff, okay? But that isn't the only kind of timeline on behaviors. In fact, you may do both of these simultaneously. There may be one piece of your audience that you want immediate behaviors from. But then there's another group that just isn't ready yet. Or maybe you sell automobiles. And you know, people don't buy them every week. So you've got this long period between purchases. Well, in that case, there's no sense in sending out appeals for immediate behavior because, you know, my old car isn't worn out yet. Instead, what we've got to do is build people's latent readiness to behave positively when a triggering event occurs. A triggering event occurs. Now, I know that's all wonderful behavioral science jargon, and us consultants know that you can increase your fees by the hour if you use a lot of that, you see, so I use a little of it. But let me tell you why I don't know of any more simple terms to use. Let's say we're talking about cars. That's something we all understand, at least the purchase of them we understand, and why they fall apart and all that sort of thing. If my car is running along all right, then there's no sense clearly in aiming an immediate appeal at me. I'm just not going to, you know, get rid of it just because yours has sexier wire wheels than mine. Okay? So what you're trying to do in this internal period is build up a positive latent readiness in me, even though at the moment you're not going to get any behavior out of me. All you're going to get is my latent readiness. And then comes the triggering event. Oh my God, it didn't start. Oh, the guy says it'll cost $500 for a new transmission. Or it's just, I'm just sick of this thing. We're going to buy a new one. That is the triggering event. In New Hampshire on Tuesday, for people who were marketing candidates, came that wonderful automatic triggering event, voting day. Everything up until then, you see, could only be building on the latent readiness. And only in those last couple of days can we really, with any surety, ask for immediate behaviors, because the triggering event is right around the corner. Now, this is a critical way to look, because too many organizations don't make this differentiation, and it's all important. Talk about targeting audiences. You may have, in fact, right here on this scale, you may have three target audiences for many of your products. Present customers are those with known immediate needs. People who don't have any immediate needs, and all we can do is build a latent readiness, and then people who are about to undergo a triggering event, which it's true will put them back in the immediate need category, but the question is, did we build their latent readiness sufficiently? Now, if we can target our audiences like that, see how much more effective even the simple communications that we do can be. Because generally, we're in the position of throwing these messages out to the wind for the millions. And yet you can see right away that if we're asking for immediate behaviors, we're turning off all of those people. Is there any evidence for this? Yes, there certainly is. Jim Grunig, probably the leading scholar in our field, one of his very first studies dealt pretty much with this particular subject. Jim did a study. As a matter of fact, he wanted to take what he considered the most prevalent marketing purchase communication in American society, and he figured if he studied that, he'd have a model for all of those that don't occur as often. And so what he took was automobile advertising. And he studied all the automobile advertising, and here's what he discovered, as many of you know. He discovered that there are active audiences and there are passive audiences. And he found that all that money that's spent on television commercials, for example, for automobiles, it isn't aimed at these people at all. It is not aimed at those people who are in an immediate position to buy a car, because they're not going to believe the ads. They know better than that. I mean, you know, you've seen the ads anyway, and the commercials, God, these guys fly, they swim, they do all these wonderful things. And the reason for that is because, you see, you're not appealing to anybody on a basis of tangibility. You're appealing to them instead for their latent readiness to build up some kind of an image that someday, when they have a triggering event, may swing into their mind and they will go. So that if someone is actively ready to buy a car, You want to try and get a brochure into their hands. You want to try and have a salesman know that, so that good dealers, for example, go through the automobile registrations, which are, of course, available on computer from the state, and they look up everybody that has a car 4 years old or more. And then they kind of compare that with the part of town they live in as just kind of a rough cut on what their financial capabilities might be. And bingo, we know some people who may be very close either to being active purchasers or to having a triggering event that will make them an active purchaser. And so for those people, we want them to read an article in Road and Track. We want to do something very targeted. The commercials are not aimed at them. The mass appeal is not aimed at them. It has to be targeted. The passive audience, however, that's where television commercials are aimed. So that, you know, the next morning you go out and maybe if they were wildly successful, they've been able to make you feel a little uncomfortable with old Susie. You know, she just doesn't perform in the way she did when she was new and the radio doesn't work and all of those kind of things. Now, there's one other time that commercials are effective, Grunig found, and that was immediately after purchase. People watch those commercials just like hawks saying, oh my God, convince me I did not buy a lemon. Okay, so there is a third stage here that we need to add, and that is the reinforcement stage. And when you get over here again, when you're making appeals to your customers, you need to add that here. There is a reinforcement activity after they've purchased. Now, the reinforcement activity, depending on the type of product, may end up being an immediate appeal to do it again if you're selling soft drinks. They've kind of adopted Dr. Pepper, your brand, as their favorite. We need to reinforce that that's a wise decision, but in that case, the reinforcement will take the form of a little added fillip on an appeal for immediate behavior. But if it's an automobile, they're not going to say, gee, I like that one, so well, I guess I'll go buy two more. I mean, that hasn't proven too effective in the automobile business. So reinforcement for them is now building up this brand loyalty, this pride in brand, so that when they have another triggering event, they'll give some behaviors. Those are the three ways of looking at behavior. Now let's really take your product and apply some real scales to it. First of all, if we're going to have a strategic plan around our marketing support, probably the first mechanism we need to look at is a scale of investment, dollar investment up one side, and emotional involvement down the other side. So that you can make a chart out of this that looks like this. And down here you have low investment and low involvement. Margarine. How many of you here have real brand loyalty toward your margarine or your butter or whatever spread you use? I mean, you know, you always go in there and say, boy, only Land O'Lakes. Only whatever it is, corn oil or peanut oil. Well, I guess there probably are some people like that, or you've probably just gotten in the habit, which is another type of emotional involvement. But generally, those are kind of low on both. Then there are products which have a pretty high investment factor. They cost some bucks, like clothing, for instance, certain types of clothing, but they have a low involvement factor. I mean, if you're going to buy a pair of hiking boots, for example, I don't know, maybe you get all hung up over whether they're Northlands or L.L. Beans, or if you buy boots in Texas, I mean, do you have to have Nakonas? You see, is it okay to buy some cheap Tony Lamas? You see, I mean, I don't know. But generally, they cost some bucks. You're going to lay out $100 or so if you get a decent pair, and yet the involvement is somewhat low. Then over here, you have some that would have very high involvement, but their investment is low. Beer, soft drinks, and cigarettes have traditionally been in that category. It's a repeat purchase. Notice that low money involvement generally implies a repeat purchase. Not always. There are things that don't cost much that you don't buy very often, too. But like candy bars. Candy bars is a good example of the breakup of brand loyalty. It used to be that, by God, you either ate Nestle's or you ate Hershey's, and that was it. Now, I mean, they've all changed their brands, so except for their flagship Nestle and Hershey brands, you don't even know who made the things. They all have some name of, you know, some catchy name. And so over here, in beer, however, there is supposedly, this is also breaking down, I'm afraid, high involvement, but it's a repeat low purchase. And then, of course, sometimes you get over here where you have high involvement, high investment, purchase of an automobile, purchase of a house, purchase of a really expensive set of clothing. Now, take a minute and look at the product that you're working on and answer two questions. First, where does it fall on this scale? And is it always in the same place? Because you may have a range of product or services, you see, that may not fit neatly. And then secondly, ask yourself, this will partly answer the question doing that, ask yourself, where are you generally on this scale? Strategy means getting a handle on all possible variables. And that's what we're going to do. You're going to go out of here with a whole bunch of these lists, and you can go back and take a look at whatever it is you market back home and chart it on this if you haven't done it before. If you've done it before, good for you. You're one of the few, yes.
Have a product that really doesn't cost very much, but requires an investment of time.
Yes, absolutely. Remember that the basic rule always is here is what is the exchange? And let me give you an example. Someone is going to speak here at the meeting, maybe it's one of you, about U.S. Sprint and their experience. U.S. Sprint is a case where, compared to the direct competition, they actually are supposedly lower in cost than, say, AT&T. And yet people aren't rushing to U.S. Sprint. Why? Well, one is perception. Who is this outfit I never heard of? I've been using AT&T for 100 years. That's part of it. That's why that perception is so critical. But there's even another factor that goes to your point. In order to get into the phone lines on U.S. Sprint, as you know, you have to punch six or eight more numbers than you do to get in on AT&T. And that involvement of time has been identified as a major barrier to, and even the saving of money won't get us to do it. So U.S. Sprint, I've been at several conferences, they may be doing it here, and I just checked in late, so I didn't get mine, but I've been at several conferences recently where when you check in, somebody from U.S. Sprint gives you a little credit card that's good for free calls for the length of the conference. Why? Because they want you to learn by practicing that punching those extra six numbers isn't that big a deal. It's known as the foot-in-door technique of changing behavior. Let people practice the behavior. All right, now, see what I mean about relationships and about marketing? That was a creative public relations idea. It's not really a communicational kind of thing, but it's part of what we ought to be doing for our clients. And someone at U.S. Sprint, in the public relations unit, came up with this idea, and I no longer think it's a barrier to get into U.S. Sprint, because I realize there's only six more numbers, and you learn them just like that, just the way you learn your AT&T credit number. So absolutely, it's money, it's involvement of your time. It's probably some other factors in there too. Risk of being sort of out there away from your friends who are all doing something else. But just take a minute and for your product or product line, chart it on those scales, and then we'll quickly go on to several others. Try to answer any one of these attempts to focus is that it brings in lots of other questions, right? Well, we're going to solve all that with a little matrix for planning, but I want to confuse you more first and get it all mixed up, because then the matrix will go better. One of the things, obviously, that you found, as this group did, and I know others did, is that it isn't just one market out there, is it? That market segmentation is critical. I mean, there's all kinds of sub-pieces of the market. It isn't just consumers. And so, clearly, we got to make that list, and we'll get to it. The next thing I'd like you to do, finish up what you were doing if you haven't, but I hope you're starting to see what I'm getting at. See, the whole goal of strategy is to take into account all the variables so that we can focus and target down, so that we can actually ask people for behaviors because we know exactly who they are, and with the research or whatever is necessary to find them. So that instead of saying to the world, if there's anybody out there that would like this product, please buy it, we can say, Mary, we know you need one. Here's the deal. Now, Think about that for a minute, and you better ask yourself back home, is your organization or your specific work involved in saying, hey, anybody out there need one? Far too much of the public relations support is in that category. We plaster the message out there. Have you read Scott Cutlet's book? I suppose everybody has had to suffer through effective public relations at one time or another. Scott and Alan's book. Well, when Scott retired finally a couple of years ago, they were finally able to get rid of him at the University of Georgia. It took some work, because he's retired three times before that is the reason. And so for the newsletter that I edit, we called Scott and we said, okay, you've been doing this for 45 years now. What have you learned? And he said a lot of good things about that we are getting better and we're learning to target and we're, you know, really becoming more scientific about what we do. But he said, there's one problem. He said, the major criticism he had in his typical poetic way, he says that we still shoot our arrows into the air to land we know not where. In other words, just kind of throw it out there. And I think he's right on target, because that's really what so what means. Is so what? You know, who is out there ready to buy? Can we get to them? Can we make an appeal that will be persuasive and fit their needs and values and go with it? And that's really what we're doing here. Now I want you to add another element. If you don't mind, since we're doing group work, let's just keep going. They're not apparently going to bring us any goodies. All we've got is tea and coffee. And so, is that right, Fred? No goodies. Okay. Somebody's on a diet, you see, and they're punishing the rest of us. But anyway, if you have to, you know, make a trip, go ahead. If you want to get up and walk around, but if it's okay, if everybody here wants to take a break, we will take a break. But if you're comfortable with it, let's just kind of keep going and take our own breaks. Add now to this the factor of brand. Are the products branded? Does brand loyalty play a part? And if it does, see, here's brand loyalty down here, isn't it? Brand loyalty can't do anything over here, but brand can maybe do something down there. I'm going to put brand in parentheses, you see, with a couple of question marks, because you may not have a brand. You may find it better not to brand your product or products in the line. On the other hand, you may find it good to brand them to differentiate them. You know all the reasons for branding or non-branding, but the question is, is branding part of this? And if so, can you get loyalty to that brand? Can you build pride into it, lifestyle loyalty? And if so, would it move any of these indicators on the involvement side? Critical question, because if you are in an organization where you answer that positively, see right away how your work targets. Now you know that all those maxims about always use the brand name and all that, those aren't just talk. That your job is to sell that brand more than anything else. Now, in organizations where brand is critical, frankly, selling that brand is more important than selling the product, as we all know. I mean, you know, if I can get them to buy Coors, whether it's Coors Light, Coors Regular, Coors Extra Gold, Coors whatever, it doesn't matter, because then they can switch categories and they're still loyal to the brand. And so, on the other hand, today, does that mean anything? I walk into the supermarket and they're having, who knows, Old Pale is on sale at 32 cents a six-pack. You know, I probably can't resist, my God. I can pay for that pocket change. So then I am usually a Coors drinker. But currently on leave of absence to Old Pale, you see. Well, then if I'm on leave of absence too often, you know, am I now an Old Pale drinker? You don't want those questions. So just take a minute and take a look at your model there and see if that makes a difference. It may not. It may make no difference in where people are in the boxes. But you better know that, because if it is, that becomes overriding. Brand becomes overriding over everything else. I'm going to go to the next one. Question one of the groups has. Let's all back up on this, because it's also one of the other indicators that I would ordinarily have you work through, and this will save you one have to work through it. The question is, if you're selling a service as opposed to a product, is maybe brand more important than in a product? And I think the answer in study after study is universally yes, because the service is intangible. You can't pick it up, squeeze it. You know, if you're selling insurance, or if you're selling education, or if you're selling medical service, I mean, you know, what do you say? Well, go ask Susie, you know, let her show you her appendectomy scar, and you can see we do pretty good work. I mean, that usually doesn't work, although I think I could get into that job of being the appendectomy scar inspector here in certain cases, but obviously there's a missing link there, and Well, someone over here, I thought I overheard you talking about degrees, for example. And again, it's all perception. It has nothing to do with reality. Somebody, I think, said a Harvard MBA. Wow, that has real punch. The fact is, they're screwing up the world. I'm serious. And I mean, every other academic institution will tell you that. They're screwing it up. They still think number crunching works. You know, they think people are little boxes to be manipulated around. And you notice that the real gurus don't teach there. There's one guru who teaches there, and he edits the Harvard Business Review. He happens to be a marketing guru, and his great theme is, remember, there are people out there. The rest of the teachers seem to have missed this message, and yet that Harvard MBA, oh my God. So now, if you had an MBA from Claremont Graduate School, do you think that would do anything for you? Only if you said, by the way, my instructor for 3 years was Peter Drucker. Oh my God. See? But I mean, you'd have to add that, wouldn't you? Where you'd say Harvard, Stanford, you see? So I think definitely. I think it's a much bigger factor. And that was one of the things that I was going to ask you to look at, was this whole question of, is it a tangible and an intangible? That's another one of the indicators that you need to add here. Okay. That was pretty easy about branding, wasn't it? I mean, that didn't give you any problems. So let's go on to something tougher. This is going to bore some of you, because I know some of you with whom I've worked in the past know this by heart. Are you familiar with the basic process by which people make decisions to buy, not to buy, to be positively latent ready or negatively latent ready? It's known as diffusion process. How many of you are familiar with diffusion? Okay, well, see if I can say it in different words then or something so I don't lose you here. If you're not familiar with the diffusion process, I feel obligated to take a couple of minutes, because this really is the beginning of it all. The diffusion process, I won't give you the long history of this other than to say that diffusion has now been studied for approximately 50 years. During that time, it has had two or three major attacks launched at it, all of which have failed miserably, and if anything, diffusion is becoming stronger every day, but it absolutely knocks in the head most of the common wisdom about how Americans make decisions. And so if someone said to me, of all that we know from communications, organizational, and behavioral sciences, what's the most important single thing that someone in our field has to know? Without batting an eye, I would say it's the diffusion process. So let me share with you what we know about. This is a map of how people make decisions. Now, obviously, like all psychology, people don't know they're doing this, but this is what we do to make a decision. The first step is called awareness. The decision-making process, quite obviously, begins with awareness. You can't make a decision about something if you don't know what it is, or if you don't know it's out there. Now, notice, however, that as soon as you or I become aware of something, we begin making decisions, because we immediately say, I'm too busy, I don't care, it's not relevant. Or we say, hey, that's interesting. Or we say, well, someday I might be interested. So we start pushing ourselves toward interest, but we haven't got time right now. So the decision-making process clearly begins right here. If we decide now or in a short period of time after some other reminders of awareness that we care about this, that it may have some meaning for us, we move into a phase called interest. This right here is the narrow window of opportunity when people give a damn about all that material that we put out. See, they don't care up here in step one. We care deeply because we want to make them aware of something that they aren't now aware of. So they don't care then. This is that active-passive audience business. But when it gets to step two, then they are interested. They actually want to see our nice little audio piece or a little video piece. They want to read our brochures. They want to gather information. That's what's happening here. In those two steps, in fact, this whole idea of information and communications are key. That's what communications can do. And by the way, that's about all it can do, is to make people aware of the thing you're marketing and give them some information to satisfy their interest. Now, in the old days, it was nice. In a slower, quieter world, people would gather lots of information during the interest phase. I mean, they would really do a pretty thorough job. Now, even on the biggest ticket items, they gather a fact here and an impression here and say, bang, that's it. That's all I got time for. So you see, our job is made more difficult, because when we finally get through to them, by God, we better score a direct hit, because otherwise they're going to just get it from somewhere else. If the relevance of this product, service, whatever it is, survives those two steps, then it moves into a phase where we have very little chance to reach it. And that's evaluation. And this is just good old human skepticality coming out. Everybody goes off in the closet and says, do I really give a damn? Can I really afford this? What will it do for me? And of course, a lot of ideas don't survive that. If they do, the whole scene changes. Because contrary to the great American ideal of us all being cowboys and independent, that is an absolutely unprovable concept. The opposite is totally true. Americans do not make decisions without other people reinforcing them. And the fourth and most important step of the decision-making process is called social trial. I've decided to, I don't know, switch brands or switch candidates. And I come into you, all my liberal friends, and I say, boy, you know, I don't know, I think I'm voting for old Jack Kemp. And you all look at me and say, who? Right, who? You're going to what? And I probably say I'm going to rethink my politics, because I don't want to be out of sync with all of these people in my life. Now, the American ideal is that, by George, we're independent. Hogwash. Hogwash. Some of the most basic studies disprove this completely. To clothes buying, for example. How do people buy clothes? Well, the National Retail Merchants Association is very interested in this, needless to say. And the salespeople in the good clothing stores are interested because, as you probably know, they work on commission. And so when they see you coming in all by yourself during lunch hour and you're going along like this, they say, oh my God. But of course they're going to wait on you. You know, they got to do that. But they know that what you're going to probably do is to take a whole lot of items, buy them, take them home. And they know when you go out the door that half of them will come back tomorrow. Because you came alone. There was no chance for social trial. And when they do sociological studies to follow up those shoppers who come alone, or you may come with somebody, but you know the person is just kind of standing there while you pick out. They're not really involved in the decision. When they follow those people home, here's what they find happens. When they get home, they kind of case the joint and hope that they can sneak upstairs and cram the boxes in their closet and shut the door before anybody sees that they have new clothes.